For the next 90 minutes, we will look at the letter to the Romans. It's one of the longest and most significant letters. Saul of Tarsus, a Jew converted on the road to Damascus after his encounter with the risen Christ, converts to Christianity and becomes one of the well-known authors in the New Testament. I believe Paul preaches in a way thinking the return of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is imminent. There is a sense of urgency and eagerness in his letters. He mainly writes to the churches he has founded. But now this is interesting. As Paul is writing for the very first time to a church he has not founded or initiated and longs to visit this place as well. The average letter in the Greco-Roman world was around 90 words long. And the average literary letter was around 200 words long. And it was typically written on papyrus. The shortest letter Paul wrote was 335 words long to Philemon. And the longest was to the Romans, 7,114 words long. Typically, a letter of 200 words long would fit on one sheet of papyrus, roughly an A4 size sheet of paper. It was not easy to write on papyrus, and usually the authors dictated the letters to the scribe or gave notes for them to follow, or a rough draft, or at times oral instructions. We see at the end of the 16th chapter that Tertius wrote the letter to the Romans for Paul. It is believed that the letter to the Romans was written mid to late 50 AD. The church in Rome had existed for several years, and the Jewish Christians were ordered to leave by a decree from Emperor Claudius. Act 18 mentions Paul meeting and working with Aquila and Priscilla in Corinth. And then we see in Romans 16, their return to Rome, as most Jews returned to Rome several years later. The church in Rome, is in the absence of the Jewish Christians, was developing and evolving a tradition and culture of its own. And now the return of the Jewish Christians with their own culture and traditions is creating confusion and minor disputes. But what is compelling Paul to write to the Romans? What is going on in that part of the Roman world that is troubling Paul? What is Pauline theology in this letter? We will soon find out as Graham shares with us the historical, cultural, and socioeconomic settings and understanding of Paul's message to the Romans. So this is just a brief introduction on Romans, and Graham would dig deeper and explain and share his understanding of this book. As I pass it on to Graham, I want to remind you to please, if possible, note down your questions, and we will address them at the end of the session. So, Graham, over to you.
Thank you, Raymond. Yes. Rome, Romans. It's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? The city of Rome. Who's been there? Yeah, a number of us. An amazing place, isn't it? I mean, the history there. When you look at what's left, can you imagine what it was like in the time of Paul? How incredibly busy it was, full of people, newish buildings, not tumble down ruins. It was quite a place. When we look at Romans, we have to think about who were the Romans? Why was Paul writing? And we need some background on the culture and information on the people he was writing to. Although most of that culture seems alien to us, Paul is laying down principles and answering questions that are just as appropriate for us today. And it should also inform our understanding of the rest of the New Testament. In the case of this letter, Paul was writing about particularly one issue, which was to deal with the problem of this clash of culture between the Jews and the ordinary Roman culture that they were in. Because you have Christians from very different backgrounds, very different understandings. He's taking the opportunity to write about this in the context of the gospel, the good news of Jesus. And I wonder if Paul wrote like this because he was going to Jerusalem after he'd written this letter. He was in Corinth, and he was going to have to leave there very soon, getting kicked out. And he probably had some foreboding because he knew Jerusalem was not a safe place for him. And although he had this plan to go to Rome and beyond there to Spain, that might not happen. And so in a way, he is putting down his big thoughts about the key point of the gospel, what it really is about. Now then, historical understanding. It's worth being clear what Paul means when he refers to Jews, Gentiles, Greeks. In the times of the New Testament, the cultural breakdown in the Roman world was something like this on the slide. The Greek Empire had only been fully overrun by the Romans within the last 100 years. Roman culture very much piggybacked on the Greek culture. So a lot of the educated and higher social groups saw themselves as quite Greek and looked down on everybody else. There are Greek gods, there are Roman gods, and they very much overlap. Often they were the same gods with different names. The Jews divided the world into Jews and everyone else, the Gentiles. There was a little bit of crossover where a lot of Gentiles were interested in Judaism, and they would be allowed to take part in the synagogue, but not many of them would actually go and become fully Jews by being circumcised. So when Paul refers to Greeks, he basically means non-Jews, just like Gentiles. An interesting thing is that you've probably heard of the Decapolis in Jesus' time. Well, that was a group of 10 cities that were basically still Greek cultured. So even Jews would pick up a lot of Greek culture. Some questions that Paul answers in Romans are these. Is there a difference between being a Jewish Christian and a non-Jewish Christian? Is their standing before God any different? Will Jews be saved simply because they are of Jewish heritage? What is the truth about the gospel? What makes us free? How does grace work? And if we're saved by faith, then how should we live? And what really makes the letter stand out is how Paul goes through the grounds for salvation and so clearly makes the case that we can only be restored to a right relationship with God through faith, not by what we do, not by who we are. So let's start going through the letter and see what Paul has to say. I hope you have your Bibles out and ready because we're going to go through Romans. You may want to see some bits. I'm going to refer to a few verses. The first 17 verses of chapter 1 give us the main thrust of why he's writing the letter and what it's about. Verse 16 is key. It's well known, but it's a key verse to Romans. I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. This is what drives Paul. This is his reason for being, the good news of Jesus, in whom we believe and trust. Now, the key point here that excites Paul is the righteousness of God. God himself is perfect. His righteousness is the expression of that perfection. God keeps his promises. He is true to everything he says. Only people who are righteous can be in his presence. And the only way we can be righteous is through belief in Jesus. And this is what drives the rest of this chapter. Because mankind has gone in completely the opposite direction. And Paul has a real go at this now. It seems to be quite a tirade that he goes into. But he is so consumed by the righteousness of God, and then he looks at the world and what it's like. When Paul talks about sin, I want to lay down another foundation. Sometimes we can have funny ideas about the word sin and what it means. Quite simply, the Old Testament and the New Testament both have two words which are translated as sin in the Bible. The first one means an offense or a transgression. The second one means to miss, like missing a target in archery. So to be clear, sin is missing the mark of God's perfection. There is a standard, and every time we miss, we haven't reached that standard, that's it. We're not perfect, we're not righteous. What we do that doesn't meet that mark is offensive to God. So to help explain why Paul is so dogmatic in these next few verses in chapter 1, let's see what life was like, particularly in Rome and in Roman times. What was the culture like? There were loads of religions. Rome itself was worshipped. There were cults. There were prostitutes in the temples. But then you also had virgin priestesses with Artemis. You had all sorts of mystery religions where people had special knowledge. And this is kind of maybe where the Gnostics came from in their thinking that a lot of the other letters in the New Testament are writing about. And Judaism was well known as another religion. You also had all the philosophies, the sophists. Plato was a big name in philosophy, cynics, stoics, Epicureans, and they all had their own take on life. There's a description of how life might be for Rome and most other large cities in the first century. This is from the Lion's Study Handbook to the Bible. I have to quote it all because it's really well done. It says, take a walk down a street in Ephesus in the first century, and we're struck by the number of small shrines to different deities, tended by devotees who feel that the god or goddess has shown them favour. We may bump into a procession, perhaps in honour of the goddess Roma. The imperial cult which worshipped Rome was very popular at this time. There was general peace and prosperity that the emperors had brought to ordinary Romans. We pass large temples dedicated to various gods and become aware of the cult prostitutes, men and women, who work in several of them, offering union with the power of the deity through sexual encounters. We realize, though, that the huge temple of Artemis in the center of Ephesus is served by hundreds of virgin priestesses, promoting sexual abstinence and the superiority of women and offering power through magic arts. Nearby is the cult center of one of the many mystery religions, offering experience of divine power through special knowledge revealed only to cult members. We know that many of them use drugs or dancing to produce ecstasy. As we walk along, we see some of the Malakoi, homosexual young men with coiffured hair, dressed to kill, some of them with their older lovers. We remember the teaching of the great philosopher Plato, who believed that homosexual love was the most exalted form of human love. We know that young children are regularly drawn into these activities and into sexual service in the temples. We pass the synagogue and notice that many ordinary Ephesians are going in. They're attracted by the antiquity of Judaism. Moses, the lawgiver, lived hundreds of years ago, long before even the poet Homer. For many, Judaism has become a solid rock in a confusing world, although few go so far as to be circumcised and commit themselves wholly. Many try to combine the worship of several gods, just to be safe, probably. Now we arrive in the marketplace at the center of the city and see the traveling philosophers and their schools of students. We pause to listen first to the cynics, who teach a simple, down-to-earth morality, how to live a good life. They can't be bothered with the intellectual Stoics teaching nearby. The Stoics tell us that God is present in everything, and we must learn to live in harmony with God by practicing indifference, so we're not affected by extremes of emotion, whether joy or sorrow. They disagree totally with the Epicureans, who are also here. They do not believe in the existence of gods or the supernatural, and teach that pleasure is the supreme goal of life. What a confusing world. So many mixed up, varied ideas. Perhaps it's not so different to life here, except it's not so obvious. Maybe Hyde Park Corner could be a similar sort of place with so many different ideas. But people generally had a fear of the supernatural, and protection came from their choice of gods. Morality was highly varied, but mostly it was promiscuous and uncontrolled. So when Paul, this true Jew who's met Jesus, thinks about that, it really gives him a problem. It's no wonder that he breaks into this tirade against unrighteousness. He is thinking about God's purity and how mankind has messed it up. And even more so, he was writing from Corinth, which in the Roman world was notorious for its poor morality. So goodness knows how bad that was. So no wonder in chapter 1, verse 22, he says, "Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles." Paul is pointing out that well-known idea that many of us have, that if we don't worship God, we will find something else to worship. Our rejection of God's standards mean we will come up with all sorts of depravity which will have consequences. God will not stop those consequences, which include the mind being closed to his truth. So when Paul says in verse 24, "Therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts," that's what Paul is meaning. Our rejection of God is reinforced by our pursuit of other ideas. Chapter 2. There's a section here between chapter 2, verse 1, and chapter 3, verse 31, the end of chapter 3. And basically, Paul is writing here about how we're all as bad as each other. No one is better than anyone else. The Jews are not better than the Gentiles, and vice versa. Because you can imagine the Jewish Christians nodding their heads after chapter one, saying, oh, yes, oh, this Roman culture, it's terrible, not like us Jews. Look at all the bad things that the Gentiles bring with them into the church. But Paul says, chapter 2, verse 1, you who pass judgment on someone else, at whatever point you judge the other, you are condemning yourself. Whether we have the Old Testament scriptures to follow or not, we all break God's laws. Being circumcised doesn't make any difference. And Paul actually refers to Ezekiel 36, where God points out the moral failings of Israel, which brought God's name into disrepute, where the prophet says, this is why Israel and Judah have to be destroyed. The Jews have to go into exile because they brought God's name into disrepute. And Paul is picking up on this and saying, you Jews are just as bad. Our only hope, Paul says, is God's grace, so that through Jesus Christ, we can be considered right with God. Chapter 3, verse 23, one of those well-known verses. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. When you hear the doctrine of justification by faith, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about this section that Paul has been writing on. Chapter 4. He's saying, he's building on his case, saying Jews have no more right to grace than the Gentiles do. Paul here thinks to himself, I know what the Jews are going to say. They're going to say, we are children of Abraham, so we have God's grace. Because this is how the Jews thought about things. They thought about the fact that they were okay with God because they were descended from Abraham, who is declared righteous. But Paul points out here that Abraham was declared righteous by God because of his faith. And that was before he was circumcised, before you would consider him being a Jew. So the sign of being a true Jew didn't bring righteousness. It was the faith that Abraham had that made him righteous, and therefore, for Jews to be righteous, they also had to have the same trust in God. Chapter 5, the first 11 verses, Paul kind of does a little, almost a revision of what he's said so far. He's covering the same ground, saying it's by faith we receive God's grace. It's the sacrifice of Jesus that has given us access to God. And God gives us peace, hope, and perseverance through difficulties, which also points to where he's heading. Yes. Romans 5, 12 to 21, the rest of the chapter. Paul goes back to reflecting on the sinful state of the world in chapters 1 and 2. And he continues on this key theme that there is no salvation by human means. When he talks about Adam, he's talking about the human condition, because the word Adam meant man, mankind. So he's taking Adam as the personification of humanity. And he's saying, just like Adam, sin came into the world. Through Jesus, God gave a way for us to be saved. And Jesus is so much more than that symbol of humanity, Adam. So how much more is that opportunity for life with him? Chapter 6. Paul is following an argument here. And he's thinking, right, those people do sometimes say, and apparently there was this idea amongst the world that came into contact with Christians, that Christians could carry on being sinful because God would save them anyway, because God's grace was so great. So Paul says, so what? Do we just carry on the same, having accepted Jesus' offer of salvation? If Paul has said that our sinfulness demonstrates God's grace, can't we keep on sinning to show how great is God's mercy? A more modern description of this line of thought might be, if God will forgive me because I believe in Jesus, it doesn't matter if I keep on sinning, if I keep having this problem, because I can just say sorry every now and then and I'll be forgiven, all sorted. Paul says, no. Before being saved by grace, we were under the control of Satan. Paul uses the example here of being slaves. Before we met Jesus, we were slaves to sin, to the enemy, to Satan, because we had no control. But under God's control, we are his slave. Our allegiance has changed to God. And we have the famous verse, the wages of sin is death, the gift of God is eternal life. The heart that says I can just carry on the same because I'll be saved anyway has not really met Jesus, has not understood the new relationship. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 6, Paul carries on with this thought and says, we're actually indebted to God through Jesus. I don't think we could say we are not indebted to Jesus for dying for us. We are indebted. We have an obligation to God. And he gives another example. Here he talks about if you're obligated to someone and they die, you're no longer obligated to them. You don't have to do whatever you'd committed to for them. And he says, we've died to sin. That no longer has control over us. We're no longer obliged to do what sin wants to do in our life. Our obligation is to God. When we meet the risen Jesus, we want to please him and be like him. Chapter 7, verses 7 to 25. Paul realizes this isn't the whole story because he says himself, I still feel I can't stop sinning. There's something in me that doesn't enable me to be the person I want to be. Sin still has a hold on me. I do the things I don't want to do. I don't do the things I do want to do. He says, in my mind, I'm a slave to God's law, but in the sinful nature, in him, his human self, he's still a slave to the law of sin. But because of God's grace, Jesus rescues us. That offer of continual forgiveness is there when we seek him. Chapter 8, verses 1 to 18. Being in Jesus frees us from condemnation. God's Spirit gives us the ability to overcome our natural tendency to sin. He enables us to call God Dad. It's a completely different relationship. And there will be a day, he says, when we and all creation will be liberated from the effects of missing the target of being an offence to God. The rest of the chapter, a lot of it is well known, and often quoted. Paul is saying that God's purposes cannot fail, and we are a part of his purposes. We have a hope for the future, and God is with us in that. Verse 26, in the same way the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We don't know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groans that words cannot express. 28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. I think it's important here to point out that what God calls our good isn't necessarily what we think is our good. God doesn't make life easy. He's with us to help us to become more like Jesus. God has a big picture that we don't see, and he is always there ready to support us through whatever we're going through. Chapter 9 through to the end of chapter 11, there's almost a diversion for these three chapters, because Paul just seems to be anguished as he thinks about his own people, the Jews, who you would have thought would have suddenly realized this was God's plan all along. They look through their scriptures and realize who Jesus was. The fact that there were so many people who had seen Jesus once he had risen from the dead. Why aren't his own people putting their faith in Jesus? The Jews are still focusing on keeping the law. He revisits his earlier points about salvation being through faith, not by knowing the Torah, the law. And he still has hope for Israel, despite the rejection there has been from them, despite the persecution of the Christians. And Paul's final thought here, really, is that he believes when his own people see the Gentiles believing in the one true God and believing in Jesus, his son, they will realize that that is God's plan, that is salvation, that is who they should be believing. So after these three chapters of almost agonized thought that he has, chapter 12, he moves on in his thought process. We are obligated to God, obligated to Jesus, so how should we live? How do we live for Jesus? So what, you could say. We know very well, don't we, verses 1 to 2, where he says, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is. Verse 3, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. Then we have instructions on how to use the gifts that God gives us. And in verse 10, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. We have chapters that are packed full of advice and guidance on how do we live for Jesus. I could have read the whole chapter, but I'll just pick out from verse 11. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Don't give up. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Paul is writing to people who are so different from each other. You would have high-ranking people who would expect to sort of lift their noses to the poor, ignore them, have nothing to do with them. But the poor are also in the church. It's not just Jews and Gentiles. It's all stratas of society. It's a real mix. So Paul is telling us how we need to treat each other so that we can work together as a church. In chapter 14, he goes into more detail about the cultural clash that we started with between Jews and Gentiles, because there are issues in particular that they would have to be coping with, working through. And the key thing is, he says, to show consideration to your fellow believers. You are different. You will have different understandings. But use your freedom in Christ to serve each other, not to insist that you are right. There's clear teaching here about how to understand each other and resolve disputes. We have churches now with highly varied people in them. They're not all white middle class. And we need to take on board what Paul is telling us in Romans on how we should work together, work things out. Chapter 15, verses 1 to 13. Key things, verse 1. We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Paul really is saying that by deferring to each other, by letting other people have their weaknesses, is actually a strength rather than demanding everyone be the same. At this point, he brings in lots of quotes from the Old Testament that look like one quote, but they're not. And he reinforces the point that salvation is for Gentiles as well as Jews. It is for all nations. God said that all nations would be blessed through Abraham. And that's a key point that drives Paul's thinking. We're getting near the end here, aren't we? Chapter 15, verses 14 to 33. This is a kind of an end bracket to what Paul's been writing in Romans. It reflects very much the first chapter. Paul basically repeats and expands on what he said at the beginning of the letter, that he was writing as an apostle. He's been to most places spreading the gospel. He wants to visit them. And he'd like to carry on to Spain. He'd like to see a visit to Rome as a launching point to minister there. And then he says, first, I'm on my way to Jerusalem to take an offering for their support. Chapter 16 is all about greetings to the people he knows in the church in Rome. It's a long list. And that just gives us an idea of how mobile people had become at this point in the Roman Empire. Most roads did lead to Rome. And the gospel spread fast because of it. And he says, you know, honour Phoebe, obviously the person who took the letter. And as Raymond said, Priscilla and Aquila were in that list, who Paul had originally met when he first went to Corinth. So to conclude, Paul says in this letter, no one at all can meet God's standard of perfection. However hard we try, we will fail. It makes no difference what our background is. Our best can never be good enough. To trust in the sacrifice of Jesus is the only way to salvation, and it's open to everyone. If we've put our trust in him, changed our mindset, he will help us in our spiritual journey. And God expects us to serve each other and to defer to each other, not to push our own ideas and points of view. So, it's not difficult to draw parallels between the world of Paul's day and our world. We have such mixed cultures. I mean, spiritualism, New Age, crystals, psychic fairs, ghost hunting, you name it, you know, it's all out there, isn't it? And although the Victorians didn't get a lot right, you know, standards of sexual behaviour have just completely gone from anything that we would have recognised from a long time ago. What drives a lot of it is the media message that no one should question anyone else's beliefs or personal morality. But Paul does. Paul talks about the differences in opinions and makes judgments as to what is right. See, there's a difference between just saying, well, you're right, I'm wrong, and saying the way you do it isn't right. We need to look at Scripture and see, well, how does God view this? And is it actually a matter that makes any difference? Is it something of importance to the church, or is it just that we have different cultures and we need to accommodate each other? So I think that we need to be careful of this balance between not being judgmental, but on the other hand, not just accepting what anyone says in the church and what they seem to think. Paul teaches us through Romans and the other letters of the New Testament that there are absolute truths. But he tells us how to handle divisions, misunderstandings, conflict of cultures. And we should try to put the teaching of Romans into practice. And that probably starts with talking openly about our differences, rather than trying to brush them under the carpet or pretend that they're not there. We need to air them in love and act like the church that Paul believed in. Thank you. I'm finished. Raymond.